Well, now, few parts of the Bible are as well known, in the second row that's there, few parts of the Bible are as well known and as frequently misquoted as Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. We need to actually look at these two chapters, 2 and 3, together. Today it'll be basically on chapter 2 with a bit of a look into chapter 3 at a relevant point. Next week it'll be basically on chapter 3 with a bit of a look back into chapter 2 at a relevant point, because the two chapters form one logical unit of man and woman in the garden and what they did in terms of eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In recent last 2 weeks I've been listening on Sunday mornings to the ABC. They have hymns at 7 o'clock, and then afterwards, after a little while, there's a show of religious interest put on by their Department of Irreligion, it would seem to me, because it just sets out to consistently and continually attack Christianity. And in the last 2 weeks, one of them was about how the Holy Spirit was a woman, and I've forgotten what the one was last week. We found Genesis 2 and 3 being misquoted yet again by supposedly religious experts, as they set up what they said Genesis 2 and 3 were about in terms of the subjugation of women, in terms of eating of the apple, in terms of sex and its role and play within marriage, within the garden, all of which were inaccurate. And it's a great distress that you have a passage which has such tremendously important things to be said, and yet people so seriously misunderstand, especially the nature of the tree of the knowledge in good and evil, of which we'll be looking at next week, and what it is, what was the fruit, why it wasn't an apple, and why it's got to do with anything related to sex, or hasn't got to do with it. But we'll look at that more particularly next week, when we see how chapter 3 understands chapter 2, and we see the fulfilment of the narrative. Today I want us to start looking at the relationship between chapters 1 and 2, because chapters 1 and 2 both give us an account of creation. In chapter 1, the creation seems to be of the whole universe, with man being the last stage in it and the pinnacle of creation. But what of chapter 2? Is it telling us a different story, with man created and then the animals after him? Well, Monday night, late Monday night, I was watching Arsenal beating Middlesbrough 6-1 on the telly. And the one goal that Middlesbrough scored, a penalty goal, caused by the fact that one of the Arsenal players was said to have handled the ball right in front of the goalpost, and he wasn't the goalie. So they got this penalty goal and scored their first goal for the last X number of months. Now, I watched the thing, and I didn't see the man handle the ball, but they gave us a replay from a different angle, and I still couldn't see the man handle the ball. They gave us another replay, and I still didn't see it, although I didn't doubt the referee saw it. Then later in the show, they gave us a replay right from the other end of the field, kind of behind the other goalie, a long shot, and they took it slowly and they actually stopped it, and sure enough, you could see there was a man handling the ball. Now, that practice and ability of looking at the same event from several different angles, which we call our action replays, and which have ruined going and watching any game in live anymore, although I understand Melbourne's overcome that problem with their new scoreboard that gives you an action replay so as to embarrass umpires. That kind of action replay is the kind of thing that you see in Genesis 1 and 2. We saw when we looked at the book of Revelation a couple of years ago, is in the scriptures as a way of recounting the same event, but recounting it from a different angle, from a different perspective, looking at it differently, looking at slow motion, looking at stopping at one point to see how it's done. And in chapter 2, we are still seeing the creation, and the great things that are said about man in the world in chapter 1 are said in chapter 2, but they're just said differently because we've got it from a different perspective. So in chapter 1 last week, I suggested that the chapter is saying three important things about man. It's saying that man is created, man is unique, and man is the Lord of creation. They all, for example, come out of verse 26. Then God said, let us make, there he is, let us make man. Man is created, part of the creation like the rest of the universe. But let us make man in our likeness and in our image. Man is unique in the only part of creation being in the image and likeness of God. And it goes on in verse 26 of chapter 1. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over the livestock. Man is placed as the ruler of the world, under the authority of God in the world. Now, chapter 1 is recounting the creation without any notion of sin in it as such. Chapter 2 again recounts it without sin, although there is the warning in chapter 2, verse 17, of the nature of sin and the consequence of sin. But you will see that chapter 2 says the same things about man in the world. He is created. So in verse 7, man is formed. God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a living being. Man is created in chapter 2 just as he is created in chapter 1. Man is unique in chapter 2. He is the one who is the gardener. He is the one to whom God speaks. He is the one for whom the other animals are created. God, the man, has a unique role in the garden setting. And thirdly, therefore, man is the one who gives the names to the animals. They are in subjection under him. To man is given all the fruit of the trees to eat, except for one particular tree. That is, the same things are said of chapter 1 are said in chapter 2. The same great themes are there, although they're being said in quite a different style and format and fashion. But it's not a different theological perspective. When we look at man in the garden, the picture that we have for us in chapter 2 is that of one of God's rich provisions. It is a garden, a paradise as the Greek translation had it, and which the New Testament refers to a paradise. Aesthetically pleasant, chapter 2 verse 9, notice that even the trees were pleasing to the eye and good for food. There is a concern for the pleasurable sight, the aesthetic sense within the creation, within this garden. But notice the trees are not only beautiful, but also producing food, which in verse 16, man is to eat freely of. There is abundance of life in the garden. He is filled with the breath of life of God, the tree of life to the garden. There is no seeming death unless one seeks to rebel against God, like in verse 17. And the presumption is if you don't rebel, then you will continue to live. The rivers that nourish the earth flow around the garden. And there are created for man and for man's need, all the animals, all of them under man, because God sees man's need of fellowship and relationship in verse 18. And God seeks to make a helper suitable for him. So the animals are created for him. They are inadequate as helpers suitable for him. So God continues in his creative activity to create the woman for man, so that man lives on these three levels, in relationship with God, in relationship with his mate, the woman, in relationship with the animals and the created world. He is placed in a harmonious context where everything he could want is provided for him. His food, his beauty, his fellowship, his helper, it is all there, created for him. And man is further given a sense of responsibility. Man is the one to whom is spoken, who is treated as a person with a will. He is directed to work in verse 15. That is the character of man, that he will work. Back in verse 5 it speaks about no man to work the ground. He is given the garden to till, to keep, to subdue, to look after. That is the work that man is called to. But the responsibility is also that he is not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in verse 17, and he is warned of the consequences of it, namely that he will surely die. And that, of course, is the part that we must look at next week when we see in chapter 3 how he does eat of that tree and faces those consequences. Now, if that's what chapter 2 is about, in terms of man being in the rich provision and the beneficiary of God, placed in the garden with a certain responsibilities, there are many implications that flow from this chapter and are worked out in the rest of the Bible. We could look to some extent, for example, the relationship between man and the animal world, and the question of vegetarianism and so forth. We could look at the subject of beauty and aesthetics and what part that plays in the Bible. But it seems to me there are two issues that are much more important than those kinds of issues that the Bible does pay a lot of attention to that we really need to highlight. One is the relationship of man to work, and the other is the relationship of man and woman in marriage. For they are issues that are fairly important to this chapter too, and are fairly important in the rest of the Bible. Both of them are issues over which we have a certain love-hate relationship. And I want us to look in terms of what it says here in chapter 2 about those things, about work and about marriage, then take account of what says in chapter 3 following, namely of what it's like outside the garden. Because when we recount what it's like inside the garden, it is far removed from us because we do not live in the garden. I know the University of New South Wales is a beautiful place and the trees are lovely. But this is not the Garden of Eden, I'd have you know. You have not arrived at paradise. Some people have only been here a week or two. They may still be under delusion, although they have to be very slow-witted. They are not in paradise. Oh, we have all kinds of faculties here, don't we? You could. They're not in paradise. And so we've got to learn, what's it like then? What's the difference outside of the Garden of Eden in terms of work and in terms of marriage? But also, seeing we are in Jesus Christ recreated, born again, made new, and going to live into a new heavens and a new earth, what's the difference now that we become Christians as well? So chapter 2 is the backdrop on two subjects that we're going to trace through quickly on the Bible. But we're trying to do it so as to understand what chapter 2 is saying about those two issues. Firstly then, work. Work is hard and unpleasant for many people. The word itself conjures up bad associations, doesn't it? You know, people say, I have to go to work. But you don't hear them saying, I have to go down to the beach today. You know, unless they're cleaners down at the beach, then they have to go down to the beach to work. You know, I have to go off and play cricket. I have to. The only people who do that are those who have to work at those kinds of things. Right? Work has in itself bad associations. And people indeed are very alienated from work, as you see it displayed in their sickies. Or in their desire for holidays, the tremendous Australian love of having more and more long weekends, the desire to reduce the number of hours that we need to spend at work, and also the stress and the strain that work creates in people, the illness that genuinely does come from it. You see it in the slackness of workers and the avoidance of work. I worked when I was going through uni, I was working in public service over Christmas vacations, and it was always very interesting to see that many a person spent more effort and energy trying to avoid work than they ever would have if they just gone and done the job. All kinds of ingenious plans devised by which one could avoid doing anything. At the same time in the public service, there were men, especially those higher up in the ladder, who seemed to me to live for the work that they were doing. And so the very service I was in for several of the years I was there was very interesting to see some people who are working flat to the boards who are actually workaholics and other people on the other score who were really, they had some terrible disease called work which they didn't want to ever catch or go near. Work is a strange thing, you see. We don't like it. But at the same time, unemployment is worse. Unemployment is terrible. Back in those days, unemployment was unheard of. But now, as we see 10, 11, whatever percent it is of our community unemployed, we're starting to see the consequences, the ravages it brings on people's self-confidence and self-worth, the boredom, the futility, the destructiveness that comes out of this terrible problem of unemployment. Terrible disease within our society. One of my friends has been applying for jobs every week for the last 2 years. Can you imagine what it's like every week to be told by other employers, by other people, you're no good, we can't use you, you're of no value to us. Week in, week out, year after year, being told that message. What do you think it does to a person? Terribly destructive to say that you are of no value to society at all. And yet that is happening around about us. And of course, as we've now decided the only way we can get our people by working is getting people to retire early, we're discovering something else, that retirement is death. We're saying you're now past it. I was speaking over the Christmas vacation with a man who had just turned 46, and he was down the beach. We were walking back from the beach and chatting to each other, and he said in 9 years he really had to retire because his superannuation benefits and all the rest of the things that were going to happen at the age of 55 were so great that it was no longer any point working beyond 55. And so he only had 9 more years, and he said, I'm a young man. I said, it's ridiculous. I don't feel like I need to retire anywhere near it. But that's the state that I'll have to be economically. So I said, what will you do? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, you've got hobbies, haven't you? And he says, oh, yeah. I said, what are you going to do them? He says, no, I'm not interested in any of them anymore. And he was a very capable man. He was playing A-grade tennis and A-grade squash and A-grade golf. He had a canoe. And he goes fishing a lot. He's got he had a catamaran. He was sailing. And he's got all the hobbies you can think of, all the activities. He's a professional man. He's got two houses and family and kids and dog. You know, he's got all the kinds of enjoyments of life that you could see around about you. But he said, I've done all those things and I don't want to spend my life playing games. I mean, that's surely not what life is about, just playing games. But there's no point working because they're not going to pay me anything that makes my work valuable anymore. So what do I do now? He's got his degrees, got his qualifications, he's climbed the ladder, he's done all the things that you're supposed to do, and he's now in the middle of life, and work has turned sour. He has lived for it, and it has cheated him. And facing retirement is an appalling prospect that has put him into deep depression. Not psychiatric depression, but he's very depressed about it. It's called midlife crisis, but you wouldn't know about it. Yes? All right, well, why is it that we have this ambivalence about work? What's it all about? See, in the garden, work is part of our world. Man is placed into the world, in the garden, in order to work. Notice verse 5 there. The Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no man to work the ground. Man is the one who works the ground. He's placed in it like that. Verse 15. The Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to care for it. Work is not something that happens after the fall. Work is not the consequence of sin. Work is part and parcel of the way in which we are created. We are created to work in God's world, to care for God's world, to look after and rule over and govern God's world. We are created as workers. It's not surprising when God becomes man that he becomes a carpenter, that he is a worker. Our God is a worker. He created the world. And he creates people in his image who are also workers. That's not all religious have that kind of view, of course. The ancient Greek thought anyone who was a worker was a slave and somebody of no consequence and importance. One of the great signs of being a person of high status and importance was having nice soft hands that never seen an honest day's work like yours and mine. That was a sign of high status. It's not that very far different today either. But not so. Get a little dirt under your hand, under your fingernails. That is the nature of a godly person, to actually be a worker. God creates us to work. And that is why part and parcel of our needs, our life, our expression, ourselves, is caught up in our work. But yet, the work of the garden is to be done under God's rule. Caring for the garden, looking after the garden, as is hinted at the beginning of chapter 2, resting on one day, like God rests on one day, as we work six. Now, what happens after the garden? Well, if you turn with me to chapter 3, verse 16, chapter 3, verse 16 and 17, we see God speaking to Adam after he'd eaten of the fruit that he was not to. And to Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, and for dust you are, and to dust you will return." This is why we have Mondayitis, because outside the garden it is not all beautiful and plentiful. Outside the garden it is hostile and hard, thorns and thistles, sweat on the brow, work, that for which man had been placed in the garden, now becomes distorted under the judgment of God for our sinfulness, now becomes distorted because of our sinfulness. We now are going to run the world our way instead of God's way. Well, our way is one which turns out to be unpleasant and destructive, and we certainly see it in society around about us, as men work as men pleasers, not caring for the world that they're working in, as people do not care for each other. They do not care for their employees, but seek just to maximise their profits and to use other people to do that, who cast aside people when they pass a certain age because they're no longer as useful to each other, where they work in order to steal, in order to cheat, in order to gain more for themselves. The self-interest and self-centeredness of people at work is also common. And work itself is difficult. No matter how hard you try, you cannot grow fruit naturally, and you can grow weeds easily. I've always been able to establish weeds. Never had any difficulty. The only fruit I've ever been able to grow naturally is chocos. And I can't see the difference between that. I've actually lined up in a supermarket once, 15 minutes, just to see who it was that ever paid money for them. At the end of 15 minutes, not one had been sold. You might like to confess to me later so that I can see what kind of people would ever pay money for chocos. Now, the work, then, is difficult and hard because we're outside of the garden. The work is now distorted because we're outside of the garden. Work is now a scene of battle and conflict for us because we're outside of the garden. because we are the sinful people we are. But that's not the end of the story. For Jesus comes as a worker, and Jesus comes to conquer the world. And although we do not see man now as the Lord of creation, we see man living in a jungle setting or in a desert setting, whichever you like, only just in control of what is happening in this world and environment around about us. A good question as to whether we'll survive the cockroaches or they us. We do not see man in control, but we do see Jesus in control. We see Jesus risen as the Lord of heaven and earth. The point's made in Hebrews chapter 2, where he's quoting Psalm 8, Hebrews chapter 2, and you'll need to look at that sometime later, that man, the ruler of the garden, the ruler of the universe, is only ever seen in the man, Jesus, who rose from the dead, overcoming the sentence and judgment of death. But if we do see Jesus like that and are committed our lives to him, work takes on new values. And Ephesians 6, Colossians 3 speak of the new values for the Christian at work. Ephesians 4 says the thief is no longer to steal, but rather to do honest work with his hands in order that he might give to those who are in need. Notice the tremendous reversal of values that are involved in work there. As a thief, he used to take from other people for himself. Now he's still to use his hands, honest hands. Now do honest work with his hands in order to give away to people who are in need. The Christian values on work will be radically different because the Christian, being in the recreation, is going back into the garden values of work, although he is still living in the world of cockroaches and chocos. When you turn to marriage, another subject of which we have interest, we also find ambivalence. See, we criticise and question and ridicule and laugh at the institution of marriage. After all, who wants to live in an institution? But 97% of Australians do. For that's what percentage of Australians marry. People want to marry. Even those who divorce, and we see an ever-increasing rate of divorce, the vast majority of them remarry. They may have considered their first marriage was a failure, but they haven't lost confidence in marriage itself as an institution. They're willing to have a go, and some have a go again and again and again. The area of debate in our society more than is marriage more than anything almost else. Whether or not we should have such a thing as homosexual marriages, whether there can be trial marriages and how we should encourage people or discourage people from them, whether there can be laws about rape within marriage, the whole question of divorce and remarriage and the settlement of children and so on, the rights of the de facto wife and the illegitimate children, whether you can move into the communal marriages and... There's all kinds of alternative marriage structures and patterns being established. And I'm sure polygamy will be on the agenda in the coming years. It's a society we live in that in this area seems to have lost its directions and moorings. And that is because there's such bitterness and unhappiness within our community. There are so many failed marriages. There is so much pain and agony that takes place in the homes of our people. It's a terrible thing, the way in which people live. I understand that you are more likely to be murdered by your family than by anybody else. That is, most murders that take place in Australia take place in terms of families. Not underworld gun slaying. That's not a great danger to you, but your family is a great danger to you. Well, a danger to you. More danger than anything else. That is, we want to get married, we want to have home life, we want family, but we just would like it better than the one we have. We'd like it done differently, we'd like it organised somehow differently, we don't want the pain and the agony that we're going through. We want out in terms of divorce, but we want at the same time to make families more stable. If you listen to the 2GB matchmaker show, comes on late at night. I was listening again last night, actually. It's an interesting show, late at night. You should stay up and try and study to it. Matchmaker Show is a Lonely Hearts column done on air in public where people, desperately lonely, frequently recently divorced, but not always, ring up and seek to find a partner for life. I understand they've just had their 19th marriage. It's only been going about 10 months, 11 months. Thousands of people have rung up during that period of time. And people desperately keen to find a partner, so keen that they're willing to go public and to spill all the beans about themselves, who they are, what they are, what they look like, whether they've got any spare parts, what their star sign is, and all kinds of other ridiculous things that are raised for them, and what kind of person they would like to meet up with in terms of their spare parts and whether they like eating garlic or not. And to give their name and address in that people would contact, it's a marvellous show for you to listen to. It's a great insight to the terrible loneliness of people in our community. The desperate desire that they have for partnership, for friendship. The terrible heart-rending agony that they are in. And the thing that I keep noticing is that universally they say, I don't want someone who's a heavy drinker. That is a universal one, that one. One in 20 Australians are alcoholics. One in four or five live with an alcoholic in their home. No one who has ever done it once would ever want it a second time. But that is the nature of one in every four or five homes of our community. And those who have been hurt and been brutalised by our society and are now so desperate as to ring up a radio show like that, they are universal in that condition. It's an interesting show. Listen in sometime. It does you a world of good. Who wants to live in an institution? Everybody wants it. But we wish it were better somehow. Well, look at how it's sped up for us in Genesis chapter 2, because this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way God created it in the first place. Notice the purpose of it. Fellowship. God sees man in verse 18, sees that he needs a helper, sees that it's not good for him to be alone. That is, man is a gregarious, sociable creature who needs fellowship and friendship. And so God, who is a good God, caring to provide all things for us richly, provides for us that we might have that relationship. The animals are an inadequate form of relationship. And so God creates a helper for man in his dominion in the garden. The helper, who is fundamentally the same as he is. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, as he describes the woman in verse 23. The same stuff and substance as me. The same. She is man. She is mankind. Woman taken out of man. The Hebrew words are much like the English words, that ish and isha. The woman has actually come from the man. They are one and the same. And that is why they can have that relationship that is not available for the man with the animals. She is fundamentally the same, and the purpose of her creation has got to do with fellowship and relationship and love and caring for each other. The satisfaction of the need for a suitable helper. But not only is she fundamentally the same, she's fundamentally different. That is, God does not create a second man. God creates a woman. Just as it's important to stress the similarity, to make sure that we grasp hold that we're talking about the same thing, the same substance, the same status, if you like, it's also crucially important to talk about the fact that it's different, complementary, not the same reproduced. It's a complementary creation here, so that the relationship can work. Because God's idea for this relationship is one of unity. For this reason, verse 24, a man leaves his father and mother and is united to the wife, and the two become one flesh. That is, the basic unit of humanity is a single person, or is a couple. The couple, the married couple, is a basic unit. They're not two, they are one, in fact. Beautiful biblical mathematics. 1 + 1 = 1. There's another piece of biblical mathematics you come across in Trinitarian discussions. There, 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. And that's a great help to those of us who are an art students here. Now, God's plan, you see, is that the two be united in a way that the creation of another man would have been the creation of two. But here is a creation that is to wind up as being one. And that unity is such as to take priority over every other human relationship, even the relationships with your own biological parents. And so he is to leave his mother and father, and they cleave to his wife, and the two become one flesh. They are united physically. Notice the role there of sex as part of that relationship. They are created differently and similarly for the purpose of fellowship. Well, now there are many implications that can flow from that view. Let me just mention a couple of them, some of them negative, because people are saying very different things today. One is that sex is good.
Please take careful notice of that. You see, sex is not part of the fall, nor is sex after the fall. Sex is in the creation of the woman. Sex is in the creation of the original couple. Sex is an activity for the Garden of Eden itself. It is good and proper and right and fitting and appropriate, and God made it for our pleasure and satisfaction. Very important to grasp hold of that. It's nothing at all about eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That has not got anything to do with sex. It's got something to do with, well, next week we'll look at it. Notice also that sex is not an end in itself. Sex is a means to an end. The end is fellowship. God creates the sexual act and the sexual partnership and relationship in order to fulfill that need of relationship, that fellowship, that partnership. And again, it's totally different to the materialist. The materialist who sees there's no values, remember last week, there's only just physical sensations. Well, sex is an end in itself because it's a physical sensation. It's one that you like or you don't like, but it's an end in itself. But that's not the case. Fellowship is more important than sex. Sex is a way of expressing fellowship and a way of promoting fellowship. And that is why it is so crucial that it be established in relationship. That sex is expressed within the context of leaving parents and being a new unit of society. Notice further, the bonding with the partners requires the distancing from the parents. Again, an important understanding and grasp that you actually are setting up a new home unit. New home. A new unit. I can't say a new home unit. A new home or a new unit in establishing the marriage partnership. And notice further, the key to the woman's role is not service and slavery, not subjugation and submission. The key to the woman's role is fellowship. It is for that she has been created, to love and to be loved. That is what she is there for. That is a marvelous reason for being, isn't it? To be loved and to love. To be in relationship, for fellowship. The reason why we have the very difference between man and woman is to satisfy our deep longings and hunger that we have for relationship. And God has done that because it is true of our nature, and he wishes to provide everything for us and for our good. Now, there are many things that you can draw from it, aren't there? But this marriage in the garden gets distorted by man eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But just as sin and judgment have affected work, so they have also affected marriage. And so when we turn to chapter 3, verse 16, you'll notice that what's addressed to woman is the judgment upon marriage, really. To the woman, he said, chapter 3, 16, I will greatly increase your pain in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. The judgment affects the woman in childbirth and in relationship with her husband. The woman now moves into subservience. He will rule over you. He will master you. The whole relationship has moved from love and to cherish into desire and dominate. It has moved into warfare. Now please note clearly what's being said here. It's not saying you should, it's saying you will. There's a big difference between you should and you will. It's not saying you should desire your husband and he should rule over you. It's saying you will. It's not saying you should have pain in childbirth, therefore make sure you don't have any form of natural childbirth that would take pain away, or any drugs, or refuse epidural blocks, because you must be pained when you're having children. Right? There are some people who will suggest that is what is being said here. Mind you, they're never consistent because they're men. They will always say at the same time that men should use weed killers to get rid of the thorns and the thistles. And all right for women to be pained in childbirth, just provided we don't have to put up with thorns and thistles. It's not saying this is the way you should now live, it's saying this is the way you will now live. That is, the nature of life has been affected by your act. And it's affected in your relationship, in that you will desire your husband, and he will dominate you. I have for many years taken that to mean that terrible sight that I've seen all too often in counselling, of the woman who is bashed by her husband but will not leave him because she longs for him and depends upon him and relies upon him. Her desire is for him, but he masters her all the time. But I've now, in reading chapter 4, verse 7, discovered that's not what it means. In chapter 4, verse 7, God is speaking to Cain, Cain is being tempted to kill his brother. And God says to Cain, in chapter 4, verse 7, if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. The word desire is an unusual Hebrew word, only used a few times in the Bible, and here it is used again within the next chapter. And so it seems to me we've got to see that's a very likely meaning to its meaning back in 3:16, especially as the word master and word ruler is exactly the same word. That is, what Cain and sin were in conflict about, the man and the woman will be in conflict about. The woman is desiring to conquer, control, master and use her husband, but he will conquer and master and rule over her. That is, their relationship will be degenerated into the warfare, into the jungle setting in which we now live instead of the garden. And that certainly is the case of the way in which people live in marriage and have for centuries, in the terrible conflict between men and women in their home, and the horror of seeing the men for centuries victorious, basically because their biceps are bigger. And we see it even in our sophisticated city now, of men and women in fighting in home, and the women being bashed is all too frequent and common in our society. We mustn't pretend because it's done behind brick veneer walls that it's not happening anymore. It most certainly is happening. Indeed, statistically, I'm sure that some of you live in homes where it does happen. That is the way of the world outside the garden. He's not saying that's the way it should be. He's saying that is the way it will be. And that is the way it is. Little wonder people don't like it. Little wonder women wish to be free. Little wonder we can read Andy Capp and think he understands us. Marriage in the recreation is again, of course, different because Christ comes as the perfect bridegroom and marries the church and sets for us the example of how the bridegroom is to treat his bride, the church, loving her, laying down his life for her, self-sacrificially, even if she is, and indeed she was, unworthy of him. And so husbands and wives are taught in Ephesians 5, Colossians 3, 1 Peter 3, how to relate to each other in the way in which the garden says we should. Though we live now outside the garden, we have been recreated. The garden sets for us the background, the understanding of what we're about in our relating with each other. The coming of Jesus shows us how it comes together. But that's another time. Let's return to the passage here. Man, work, and the marriage. You have in chapter 2 the setting up of the scene of two ways to live. God's way, and then just in verse 17, that there is an alternative way. We're going to see that we see that God's way is a good way, everything richly provided. We will see next week when man chooses his way that our rebellion will affect everything that we are doing and destroy the good things that God...